Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Winter Youth Sports Digital Summit that we recorded in December of 2018. The full summit, along with our full summer summit, is available on our website for theloveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, and sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. Love to hear your feedback, comments down below, and please share this out to others in your space so we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat. Thanks for joining us for our second digital summit hosted through our platform for the Love of the Game. We've got a great group of speakers for this coming summit. If you haven't been able to sit in on any, I'm sure that you're going to learn some great nuggets and tidbits, tips and tricks to add to your tool basket as a coach. Our next guest is Kyla Hartnell. She is the founder and owner of Long Lake Physiotherapy Clinic in Nanaimo, British Columbia. She's also the sister of Scott Hartnell, a long-term NHL player in the NHL, played 17 seasons. They co-authored a book called Hartnell Down, which she graciously sent me a copy of. And it's a great children's book on how to overcome adversity. Her practice and physiotherapist focus on prevention and recovery of various injuries and works with many of the sports groups in Nanaimo, British Columbia. Kyla, I'm really looking forward to our chat. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Glenn.
So the first question I've asked everybody, and regardless of what space they're in, where did you grow up and what sports were you involved with as a kid and family as well?
I grew up in Saskatchewan, super, super, super small towns where the only thing available for us 8 months of the year was a rink. So I skated. My mom took me and my brother skating twice a day. We had an outdoor rink at our home residence, and we had an outdoor rink at our school. So definitely skating was the thing that we grew up doing the most. But in the summer, we definitely played a little bit of ball. We rode our bikes. We swam quite a bit. So hockey was part of my life. I also figure skated. I also played ringette because that's what we had, was a nice sheet.
In a backyard rink, which would have been probably stellar.
You could go out
every time you wanted to. My past and growing up in Montreal, a lot of the first couple of years that I played was outdoor rinks because the younger kids, for whatever reason, got the raw deal. And the 4 a.m. game times, I'll never forget it as a kid, like getting up in the middle of the night, go play your game, come back, go to sleep for two more hours, then go to school. So there's nothing better. But when those rinks were empty, as when we were go out there and play for hours and hours on end. So good to hear that there was other sports involved as well, because now we're in a space where kids are just playing hockey year-round and then they're burning out. And I'm sure you're dealing with a lot of those overuse injuries.
You bet.
So what was it like growing up with Scott?
Well, Scott was 9 years younger than me. I had three younger brothers.
Okay.
And between the three of them, they definitely were tough on me. We had a very competitive household. So whether it was who could build the best snowman or who could possess the puck, it was a very competitive household. Made us each individually a lot stronger. We were also a very emotional family, lots of love, lots of hate at times. Mom used to have to break up quite a few fights. But again, I maintain it's, you love to love us or you love to hate us. The Hartnells are a very, very passionate family, very, motivated, very driven, and very fun loving. We love to laugh and love to cajole each other and enjoy each other's company.
Right. So it sounds like a great upbringing. And what led you then? You were in Saskatchewan. How did you end up in Nanaimo?
I drifted wet. I did get tired of the rinks and of the cold. I traveled. I drifted into physiotherapy and then traveled the world and fell in love with the mountains and the ocean when I was in New Zealand. And Vancouver Island was so similar to New Zealand that I decided to come. I wanted to be back in Canada. And so I came to the island and I've been here ever since.
Yeah, it's a similar path that I had. I'm Canadian, never went out of the country, but Montreal, Toronto, Ottawa, We had a year and a half in the Northwest Territories, Baffin Island. And then when we ended up in Vancouver, it was like, we're not going anywhere else. Yeah. I mean, we've got the mountains, we've got the scenery. Yes, you can play sports, but it's totally unique compared to Eastern Canada. Ironically, my son went on a hockey exchange to New Zealand and just absolutely loved it. And he says, Dad, it was just like BC. Like there was mountains, there was mountain biking, all the stuff that we have here, except 14-hour difference time frame and challenges to get there in Auckland and what have you. So, kind of interesting path. So, you co-wrote a book with Scott called Heart and All Down about how to overcome adversity. Maybe share some tidbits as to why you wrote the book and what some of the key takeaways were in it.
You betcha. So, I'm not sure if I can back up just a little bit to the inception of the Heart and All Down Foundation, but my brother has an awful habit of falling down on the ice, and there was a fan that kept on tracking him and counting these number of falls, and he would hashtag all of his falls and present that number in the stands. And one day when Scott was leaving the ice, he asked one of the security people to go and get that fan, and when Scott realized that he was actually counting the number of times he hit the ice, he laughed, he signed his jersey, and the Hartnell Down Foundation was birthed. And from there, Scott, every time he fell down, he donated money to his foundation. And then he started hosting events, Chow Down with Hartnell Down, and a bunch of other things where he would raise money. And that money would go towards parks that were inclusive, hurricane recovery efforts, kids from inner cities attending hockey camps. And we decided at one point in time that we should write a children's book. And I've always gravitated towards really cheesy poetry. So I decided that one night I'd stay up and I would write it. And it was easier than I thought. You know, it rhymes, it's catchy. There's lots of great phrases in hockey that fit together, you know, upstairs where mom keeps the cookies. And it was an easy inception, and the artistry was done by a Saskatchewan artist as well. And we loved Philadelphia. We'd all visited Philadelphia so many times, it made sense to put him on the top of the Rocky Steps at the museum. And it was a book that caught fire, and he's read it to many different schools and libraries, and we're super proud of it.
Yeah, and adversity is some of those biggest challenges because of kids pulling out of sports, not getting into sports, and not able to be resilient like we were with all the free play we did, you know, bumps and bruises and broken bones and all that kind of stuff. Parents protecting their kids so much that they're struggling when they get older, you know, having to overcome it. And it's a real big issue at the collegiate level now. Or there was a study that was shared out, I can't remember the actual stats, but I do remember that over 80% of the kids that were surveyed were extremely overwhelmed. Over 70% were sad or lonely. But the thing that really got me is 8% of like 100,000 students that were surveyed seriously considered committing suicide. Okay. And it was like, we've got to change that, because the mental psyche and the negative stigma, and thankfully, you know, Bill Letztalk has jumped on board and Mike Babcock has jumped on board. And all these people are saying, hey, you know, it's not negative. It's, let's figure out how to, that's a total spinoff from the adversity. But planting the seed early on when the kids are young, and hopefully will help them when they get older. So that's great that you did that.
Yeah. I often don't think that there's enough discussion about the psycho-emotional aspect of athletic development, particularly in 12, 13, 14-year-olds. And are you hurt is a different question from are you okay? And learning how to breathe and learning how to communicate the fears and anxieties that are involved in making decisions about team play and your participation in sport. Those are very difficult conversations for young athletes to have with parents and with coaches. So I can see where you're coming from. I don't really feel that until you're in your early 20s that you really have a good idea of who you are and how strong you can be. You look for cues from your parents and from your support group, you know, how for strength and for support. And it's so important that we offer them.
Yeah. And just building that overall confidence as they go through the pipeline, which sadly many of them are not going all the way through, or 70% of them are pulling out. Doesn't matter what sport they're playing, because of a lack of confidence and a myriad of other issues that are as leading to that. So did Scott at ever at any point share with you, you know, he played 17 years in the NHL, which is an astounding career. A big fan of him was, especially when he was Philadelphia and he grew his hair long. And I tried to do that. I had my, the color of my hair was the same, like that kind of, you know, brightish, kind of orangish red. And my nickname was Carrot Top when I grew up, which painfully I had to deal with my whole life. But when I tried to grow my hair, I just went like that instead of long. So it didn't really work that well. But in terms of his NHL career, did he ever share with you some of the most valuable life lessons that he learned from playing at that level and or sports?
Yeah, you know what? I remember one year in particular, and this is going to be a huge nod to Jaromir Jagr. They were having a very successful season, and I think they were involved in the Outdoor Classic that Christmas. And so there was a lot of cameras around, a lot of media around that Christmas, and he was hosting a Christmas get together with his teammates, and Jagr took him aside and said, "Stay focused, Hartnell. Like, stay focused. We got to get Giroux the scoring title. We want to win the President's Cup. We want to go deep in the playoffs. And you're an integral part of that." And Jagr he really held Scott accountable, and Scott was so appreciative, and I think passed that along as well. You know, that the veterans hold the rookies accountable to the goals, and the leadership team has to be very cognizant of staying focused despite all of the distractions. No, they had a great season that year. It totally went the distance, and he was so grateful to have that experience.
Yeah, and that's the big, you know, leaders leading the way for the young pups that are coming into the league. And there's this big transition in the NHL now, where there's a lot of young guns and all these teams that are looking for that leadership. And that's why I was kind of hoping with the Canucks that the Sedins would have held in for one more year, just kind of mentor those young prospects and Pettersson and all these kids that are coming in. But that said, they also had an amazing career, and I don't think there'll ever be anybody cycle the puck like they did. Yeah. And a funny story about Jaromir Jagr, I was at a conference 4 or 5 years ago, and Kevin Constantine was there, who had coached the Penguins and had Lemieux and Jagr on the team. Yeah. I'm not sure if it was the Stanley Cup year or the year before. He said, "Hey, is anybody in this room ever, anybody ever watch Yagi?" That was his nickname for him. He said, "Did you ever watch him play?" And everybody's kind of like, "No." And there was like 300 on the stands when he was doing this. He goes, "He never skated backwards, ever, ever." And I'm like, you know, I never thought about it. And then I watched a few, because he came back to NHL and watched the games, and I'm going, yeah, he never went backwards. So Cassidy gave the great joke that, and I can't even pronounce or even imitate how he did the accent. Yeah. But he goes, "Yagi, I'm noticing that you're never skating backwards. Like, what's going on with that? Because it's a whole transition game, agility." And Jammer says to him, he goes, "Coach, my job is to score goals. Have to go forward." And I was like, that's not everybody that's, I was like, yeah, you're right. But hockey is a game of north, south, east, west, back agility. And he was right. I never saw him actually skate backwards. It's kind of amazing for the career that he had. So,
yeah. I've often chatted about, you know, the importance of the first 6 years of a sport. All three of my brothers grew, like, the two older boys went to NCAA tier one schools, and Scott just was a little bit bigger, a little bit stronger, and a little bit more fierce. You know, they all played on small town teams that were not tiered. Like, so the best player in their age group was playing with conceivably the least developed player in our entire community. So, you know, there's so much focus to play with better and better players at younger and younger ages. And yet, at the same time, I think it was really important to develop confidence and carry the puck and have fun and be with your friends. And it's shifted so far the other way. I'm kind of curious if we can bring it back.
Yeah, that's a big the what's the word, moving the needle or the magic pill. And everybody I talked to in the space, wherever I've been across the country, they're all looking for that answer. But right in the middle, and I believe strongly that one of the biggest challenges we face is we've gone through the whole 20-year internet phase where the digital era has just kind of taken over, and so many kids are spending so much time in front of screens. How do we wean them of that and get them off the dopamine fix, aka Simon Sinek, which is actually a brilliant 15 minutes that broke the internet? Will it get back to the good old days where we are all kind of like, you know, upbringing with the backyard rink, you know, playing free play and all that stuff? Probably not. But somehow, some way, we got to find kind of find a happy medium where kids do get their minimum physical activity required. I mean, your space, you've got to get out there and get active and enjoy, and everything being in moderation instead of excess. Like early specialization is not moderation. You know, that's going to preface into my next question as a physiotherapist. How many kids have you dealt with that are dealing already, and at how early, with overuse injuries?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I see a lot of kids coming in with back pain. And it's, they're trying to perform individual skills that their body isn't physically capable of doing. It's somewhat simple biomechanics or simple physics. The coach can yell, shoot harder as many times as you can. But if they only weigh 95 pounds and they haven't filled out, there isn't any more power to be generated by their young skeleton. So I try and hold them together and give them faith that if they continue to persevere, that they will grow. We don't know when, but as they grow, that they will be one step ahead, because they are laying the groundwork and doing the little exercises that are going to keep them together. And I see a lot of postural faults in youth nowadays, because they do spend so many hours on electronics. They collapse in their chairs at school. They have a real forward head posture and don't do enough other sports. I always say to parents, when you book your appointment to come and see me, if you can't get in for a few days, take your kid to the pool. Let them play in the water. Let them ride a bike. You know, pick sports that are less impact and more explorative, and let them try and heal their own tissues, and the risk of, you know, furthering the injury is so minimal when you're in the water. I use this analogy too, that I used to work with the national rugby team in Victoria, and if they played a hard game on a Saturday, their team was in the pool on a Sunday, and it just enhances their recovery and allows them to be silly in the water and really, you know, reflect on the game from yesterday and look forward to the next week and not worry as much about the aches and the pains, because some of them are really truly just little bumps that need to be played through.
Right.
And you know, it's a lot of education on how to be mentally strong and how to differentiate what things are safe to play through and then what things do require the assistance of a professional.
Yeah, and the big challenge is the recovery time. I mean, the ice baths is another one that people will use, and I've never gone down that path. But I went to a conference a few years ago. Brendan Burchard is kind of like a guru with a thought leadership, and just was curious on how he – one of the things he does after every conference, he has an ice bath after a full day. And he says he gets up the next day, and he feels like brand new. I've never tried it, but I'm told it's a great therapy. But the second to me was always getting in the pool. You know, any sport I was playing, we'd jump in the following day just to kind of recover. And literally what you're saying is turn the brain off. Don't worry about the results and all that kind of stuff. So going to an analogy. What about the infamous Tommy John's surgery and or the arms with pitchers? You deal with any baseball players at all?
Yeah, we see a lot of medial elbow pain for sure. It's usually faulty technique compounded by repetitions. So it's hard to get kids to buy into the fact that what they're doing with their hips, for example, is the cause of their elbow pain. And to really say, okay, you need to spend, you know, 6 weeks to 3 months re-sequencing and you know, stopping the faulty habits and really like start from the ground up and restore proper mechanics to your throw. See it all the time. I don't see the extremes where parents are wanting to get things done prophylactically necessarily. So the surgery before it even happens, it boggles my mind that that's even been considered, but yeah, for sure.
Yeah, a lot of the parents, I'm just hearing through the grapevine, I haven't actually personally talked to, but they're thinking it's going to convert to a robotic arm, get 5 miles an hour with a 14, 15, 16-year-old, where it's now 60% when, and like, John Smoltz, when he went into the MLB at, you know, what, I can't remember how old, he didn't have his Tommy John until, I think, 34.
Yeah.
And it was just to give him a few more years of, you know, that experience, and he's, like, beside himself, like, why are 15, 16, 17-year-old kids getting Tommy Johns? Because that's all they're doing. And they're introducing curveballs way too early. And I think you nailed it. And one of the biggest challenges with coaches, regardless of sport, they don't focus enough on the mechanics, the biomechanics, is A, they don't have the expertise.
Yeah.
And B, they can't recognize the error and break down the error, which is a big issue that I see all the time with all this, particularly in hockey, when we evaluate practices, coach running a practice, they run the drills. And then they run another drill and another drill, another drill. But I don't see the error correction, whether it be mechanical or technique or whatever the case may be, happening. So the whole coach decides to look, you know, that's the key. That's when you've got them on the ice. You've got to break down that error, because otherwise they're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing. A, it's going to lead to injuries. B, they're going to only stop on their dominant side and or go. One of the power skating coaches that I talked to, so watch the NHL, and there's a lot of players in the NHL now that are very comfortable with the right over left crossover, but not so much with the left over right crossover, because coaches are just saying go two laps, and they always go counterclockwise, toilet bowl, but not have them go the other way so that they focus on dominant sides. Another overuse injury that's pretty predominant is girls with ACL and MCL because of soccer. Same thing. Coaches aren't focusing on the mechanics and making sure they're working on both sides of the body. So how do we change that? How do we get the coaches to buy in to the science instead of just the wins and losses? Because that's really where it's kind of gone.
Yeah. I used to be quite concerned that if I could identify in an athlete a deficiency, so they've got excessive mobility through their shoulder or they're collapsing medially through their knee, you're at high risk for a shoulder dislocation, you're at high risk for an ACL tear. I used to really try and hold those athletes back and get them to work in my setting and try and resolve the deficiency. And I think about 5 years ago, I changed my tune a little bit, and I started to let go of the control and say, I want you to explore movement more. I want you not necessarily to the sport that you absolutely love, but I want you to go play in the monkey bars. I want you to go wrestle. I want you to go do some gymnastics and some vaulting and some yoga. And I think there's a specific phase in youth athletic development between the ages of 8 to 12, where kids don't get the opportunity to do a lot of motor exploration. So they're not sequencing, they're not tumbling, they're not wrestling, they're not learning to control their center of gravity. And if you can control your center of gravity and then figure out how to control your opponent's center of gravity, you've figured it out. That's sport. That is particularly contact sport, but even something like basketball where you just have to know how to stay low and then how to jump high. Like it's so basic. So I'm encouraging parents to, you know, at age eight to twelve, take a look at your summer months and take a look at your spring breaks and put your kids in camps that encourage exploration of movement and let them play as many different things as they possibly can. And that alone, I think kids intuitively figure it out, how to balance, how to stack, how to explode, how to zig, and then how to zag. And it comes together. I don't think it has to be the sole responsibility of coaches. I think it has to, you know, our phys ed programs in schools have drifted away from doing some of this. And our spare time has definitely shifted away from, you know, outdoor play to indoor electronics. So, I'm optimistic it'll come, but it has to be addressed by all levels of care, all levels of authority. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's gotta be synergies between health and, coaching and sports organizers, executive, all the groups have to recognize the importance. You know, I'm going back way back in time when I went to UBC, did a degree in motor control performance, biomechanics, and I had a really amazing professor who was in that space. His core motor skills are between 9 and 12. And if kids are not exposed to all the different activities, like you were saying, get up, fall, zigzag, everything, biking, running, swimming, they're not going to develop their core competencies. They're not going to become athletes. And this is way before specialization was even a conversation.
Yeah.
But that's an analogy that I got from someone. Her son went on a hockey exchange to Finland, came back. Her son, because she worked in the space, goes, "Mom, all the kids in Finland are motor morons."
Yeah.
Meaning they were great at hockey because that's what they did year round. But whenever they played hacky sack or soccer, basketball, you know, just free play activities, dryland, what have you, they couldn't do it. And I have talked to people that run dryland programs with elite AAA or A1 players, because people watching this from across the country, A1 is a specific BC. They couldn't run. Like, they had to stop the drylands and say, okay, we got to show these kids how to run before we, you know, can actually get into any of the activities. So how do we bring, I mean, that kind of precursors, because one of the things you shared with me is you ran a program called, was it Got a Game?
Got Game.
And was that really because you saw and wanted to get these kids exposed to all these different various activities?
Yeah, so I think at the time my son was 11 years of age, and he wasn't thrilled with the thought of playing baseball. And I wanted to hold him back a year before playing lacrosse. So I'm like, well, let's play a bunch of different sports. And there was a school that was quite central in town. And I had 30 kids sign up, and we played 10 different sports over the course of 8 weeks. And it was brilliant. European handball, we played ultimate frisbee, we played football. We even managed to do a little bit of golf. And I convinced the kids that we should try pickleball. And at the end of the 8 weeks, I had them rate, please identify your two favorite sports and please identify your two least favorite sports. Yeah. And it was quite curious, because the pickleball was a beautiful sunny day. We have brand new courts in Nanaimo. We had great instructors, and they had success early because of the sport itself. It's not meant to be high speed and deep lunges. You're meant to have volleys and have success early on. Okay. And they did, but the culture of that sport is so stigmatized to being for senior citizens that the kids didn't accept the fact that they had a blast playing it. And it's something that could be intergenerational, and it could be something that develops hand-eye coordination for any other sport. But so this is just us, you know, making sure that we, you know, I make my hockey players play ringette. I try, and I took I had a birthday party for my son, and we it's a target practice. So we set up a whole bunch of glass things at one end of a court, with a tarp underneath, of course, and we fire pucks at these targets, and there's competitions, and they can win chocolate bars and things like that for being able to hit these small targets. But before we started, I had this big clock at the other end of the court, and I had some baseballs. And so these are all hockey kids. And I said, let's see who can hit this clock. And I was blown away. It took 8 rounds before somebody could hit the clock.
Throwing, like actually throwing the ball?
Taking a baseball and throwing, you know, just the length of a tennis court, basically. And it made me sad that, you know, they can take a puck and they can hit a drinking glass, you know, that's perched on a pedestal, but they can't take a baseball and hit a clock. So, you know, this is, I think, a perfect example of, you know, we just need to keep exploring multiple approaches to motor development. And that's going to increase their success. It's going to increase their level of fun. It'll prevent injury. It'll increase their stimulation. It'll just be a win-win from all aspects.
Yeah, absolutely. It helps them become not just a great hockey player, but a great athlete. And that's the biggest challenge we face in this space is that lack of athleticism. It just blows my mind. Like a perfect example is not just the young age group, to show you how the specialization model has kind of been like a 15-year phenomenon. I was at a fundamental movement skill workshop, and I was basically paired up with a water polo coach who had also been a swimmer and a basketball player in his youth. And the instructor wanted us to basically teach the other person how to throw with their non-dominant hand. So baseball and soap, I mean, played it all for many, 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 many years. It was just natural. Okay, yeah. Throw right-handed, throw left-handed. So he goes and grabs, and we're not using baseballs because we don't want to break the glass, but we're using beanbags.
Yeah.
And he's 6 foot, I'd say probably 6 foot five, a few inches taller than me. And he goes to release this beanbag and he's constantly hitting the ceiling. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. I'm like, what's going on here? He goes, I don't know. Like, nobody ever showed me how to throw a ball. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. He was probably 26.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and beside him, there was a circus coach and then there was a boxing coach and they're all in their about 20s. And they all came to me and said, oh, can you show us how to throw? Can you show us? I'm like, wow. Like, and for me, it was depressing because probably the most fun I ever had as a dad was playing catch with my daughter, playing catch with my son, whether it be a football, or rugby ball, whatever the case may be. If you can't throw a ball as a kid, what happens when you become a parent and your kid's never going to play like catch? Like, that's just a fundamental basic for me as a parent. And that's the thing that kind of got me. And I was like, we really got to refocus how we're doing this.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So, question I ask everybody in the space, what do you think are the top three issues that we're facing in youth sports, your coaching hockey? What do you think they are? And what can we do to reverse them?
Top three issues facing youth sport and hockey.
Well, it doesn't have to be hockey, but just youth sports in general, because you've been in the space. But
yeah. Well, early specialization, for sure. Creates early burnout. And I Cochrane, Alberta is actually an interesting example of this, that there's, they know that kids want to play spring hockey, but that it's not necessarily advisable. So their lacrosse association piggybacks their lacrosse practices on top of their hockey practices in the spring, so parents can drop their players off and they get the opportunity to play an hour of hockey and then an hour and 15 minutes of lacrosse. And I think if our associations weren't so competitive with each other for registrations and for time, that we would have the opportunity to enhance each other. It would be very collaborative. I see a little bit of a return to this in our community, where there's a little bit more focus on physical activity outside of the sport that you're participating in. So again, we're talking about diversity of movement. We go hiking. We go to yoga classes. We go to the gym. We're playing relay races. We're warming up with a basketball for hockey. I think there's a little bit more diversity coming, but it's got a long ways to go, and it needs to continue through all divisions, so that it's something that's embraced right from from early onset to right through to juniors.
Yeah,
and probably the third would be the cost, to be honest. Sport has gotten so expensive, and there's no sign that it's going to level out or go the other way. And it makes me really sad that there's a lot of kids that don't have the resources to enjoy sport and you know, tap in. They don't have a clue that they are capable of performing athletics, and they don't have coaches at their schools, and they just miss out. It's so sad. It's so sad. They don't get the hunger for movement, the laughter of camaraderie. They don't get to feel like the nutritional, you know, every aspect, the need for sleep, the need for, you know, looking forward to Saturday afternoon's game. Like, kids need to feel that. And there's just such a huge sector of our community that doesn't get to experience that because of the cost barrier.
Yeah, and the cost is a real passion point for me, because I couldn't afford to keep playing hockey. So I couldn't afford to keep my son in hockey. So he ended up quitting, because it just got, it's going through the roof. And one of the biggest drivers is the travel. And I'm just like, why do we need to travel? If you're in British Columbia, there's a lot of great hockey in British Columbia. I mean, you're on Vancouver Island. I always would go to the island for a tournament and or say the interior, but not to Phoenix or, you know, Minnesota, like people traveling all over the place. So that's like a $3,000 tab for a family that may or may not have the money to do it.
Yeah.
And everybody's kind of going, well, this is rep hockey. This is what you signed up for. Well, you know, I just want my kid to play a game and then play another game. And I'll give you a cost-effective model. I ended up coaching high school rugby for a few years, and they didn't have a coach. I loved the game. I played it, and my son was actually say, hey, Dad, you know, can you help coach? So got involved, and we created this model that was, I think, the most cost-effective model ever on the planet. I was able to, because the student fees are very, they don't have a budget anymore, but that probably the most expensive thing we had to deal with is if we had to bus to a game. So parent in schools now, they rely heavily on parents to drive you to away games. Yep. So I had a bunch of parent volunteers, which was great. And we played, we started practicing in February, went till middle of May. I think we played 16 games, had a whole bunch of practices. We had a bunch of team bonding activities. Our fees for the entire season was $125, which included a $45 hoodie. Like, I mean, how can you not? All the kids had to do, and the only thing I said is, the only thing I want you have to get is a pair of cleats. That's about $100. Everybody signed up. Okay, so $250 basically, and you got to play a sport for 3.5 months. Where else can you do that? Like, and that's what it was when I grew up. Like, when I played football, it was $125 for reg fees. All the equipment was included. You just need a pair of cleats. Rugby, the same thing. Baseball, same thing. So I played all three sports 1 year. I used the same pair of cleats for all three sports.
Yeah.
No, you need a special pair of cleats for this, special pair of cleats. That's where it's kind of got it. The marketing and the business. And the U.S., it's now a $15+ billion model. And there's no signs it's going to slow down anytime soon, because of the privatization, everybody's making money. So how do you turn it? And that's that magic pill that everybody's looking for. How do we reverse that?
Yeah.
That's a tough one, because when it gets money involved and it's your livelihood, you're probably going to fight back, and you're going to market even that much harder, right?
Yeah.
So, sad. So that's the issues. Any insight, what you think we can do? Like, you did your Got Game program. Is there any other thing that we could do to kind of bring it back to, I guess I call it reality for kids?
Yeah, it's got to be partnerships. It has to be, you know, municipalities collaborating with corporations and the education system, and just really recognizing that we've created a generation of kids that don't know how to move or don't know how to move well, and if we can, it might be them that realizes too late that they missed out, and they, in 10, 15 years, they turn around and correct what we unfortunately let go by. So I'm hopeful. It's, you know, you have to have fun and you have to move, and your physical health long-term is dependent on it. Hopefully the next wave of administrators are able to recognize and collaborate and create partnerships for success.
Yeah, I agree. It's the collaboration, like kind of what your example Cochrane's doing.
Yeah.
Multi-sport participation, semi-amo minor hockey. I've actually got the coordinator there is going to be part of the summit, and their equivalent soccer association in South Surrey. They're collaborating in terms of scheduling to allow kids to play hockey and soccer in the same season. It's kind of unheard of because they compete for that athlete. They both want them to specialize. They both want, but they both recognize that, you know, kids are burning out, they're quitting, and the attrition that we're facing. So starting to see that momentum, get more from sport. Nova Scotia did a great program. So starting slowly but surely, and they're kind of setting the bar. I think we're beyond that point of education. That was a big thing for the last 5 years. Now we're starting to see, thankfully, activation, where organizations are collaborating and starting to make it move the needle in the direction that we need to, albeit it's going to take years for that needle really to move, but I think we're starting to see that shift. So the question I ask everybody, what are the top three characteristics when you were growing up and or that you've seen of the greatest coaches that you ever had?
You know, when you spoke in front of our community group, I have to admit that I'm a right side of the room person. So I really love intelligence. I think you have to, I think you have to be able to think the game as a coach.
Okay.
And if you can think the game and also really think and analyze the skill set and the composition of your team, you're going to find ways to have fun and ways to have success. You can't fit a square peg in a round hole. So if you try and make a team play a certain way that is they're incapable of playing, you will get very frustrated. So I love intelligent coaches. I love resourceful coaches, and by resourceful coaches, I mean you can't do it all. So you have to be able to bring in people that are going to supplement what you offer as a coach, and you have to really think outside of the box for that. So it can be emotional, it can be nutritional, it can be just, you know, a different level, talking about, let's have sensitivity to people who have disabilities and play sports, like a grant exposure by collaborating with different resources in your community. I think that's so important. So those are my two on the right side of the room, and on the left side of the room, I think you have to be able to laugh. You have to have ways to have fun. You know, play with the opposite stick hand, play with one hand behind your back, you know, play cross ice. Like you have to be creative, and you have to recognize when your team is missing out on the fun factor. I think the dressing room has to be light. I think kids understand that they've made a mistake. I don't feel like we have to pound that into them. So keep it fun, keep it lighthearted, and really, really let them enjoy the experience that they're trying to create with their peers.
Yeah, it really should be the kids' journey, not the adults living vicariously through the kids, which is really how it's kind of evolved. So I've got some rapid fire questions. What can we do to ensure kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning?
I think setting goals at the beginning of the season, and then coming back to those goals and recognizing, hey, we did this, we achieved this, we created, we had success here, we traveled there, we climbed that, we surmounted this, we, you know, you guys are a tighter group of friends for that. I think you do really have to, and when I say this, don't give it verbal homage, like write it down. Put it on a piece of paper, communicate it, bring it back mid-season, bring it back at the end of the season, and really congratulate the group on achieving the goals that you set out at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. And that's one of the biggest shortfalls I see is I've always, because of my degree, goal setting was really important to me, and also all the sports I played, goal setting with coaches. So I've always encouraged coaches, how many of you do goal setting with your players? And very few hands go up. And not just the team goal, but also the actual individual player goal, because what do they want to get out of the season? So I'll sit down with all my players at the beginning of the year and say, okay, what's your individual goal? You want to work on X, Y, and Z. What do you think our team goal should be? Because that way you can then, you know, regroup with them mid end of season and you accomplish this. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
The other challenge that we have is most sports don't do quantitative, measurements of how that improvement has transposed. And it's probably one of my biggest pet peeves. So with the hockey, and I don't even know if they still have it, there was a Hockey Canada Skills Challenge available through. Yeah. I did that every year with my team.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of those players went down that pathway, like probably about 10 of them, 6 years of that. And they saw their growth and development as a player. Yeah. You know, they balanced the agility, the passing. And it was quantitative. I could hand that to them like a report card and say, hey, this is how much better you got. It's not about the score and the win, you know, wins and losses. It's about you as a person. And
yeah.
Parents just loved it. They just thought, this is fantastic because nobody else is doing this. And it was a little bit of extra work. Yes.
Yeah.
But that said, you could give them something that they could grow on and develop and build on every season.
Yeah.
We need to do a little bit more of that, I think, so that kids actually see where they're going and not just from a team on the scoreboard, but they as people are growing in their respective sports. So great answer. Okay. What would be your favorite book and or resource to recommend to coaches?
Oh, you know, it's funny that you say that because it wouldn't be a coaching specific book. I've always loved Bryce Courtney's The Power of One. And it was made into a movie. I think it was Matt Damon actually that may have been the boxer in it, but it's The Power of One is all about the ability of one person to create a change. Are you familiar with that book, Glenn?
List. John O'Sullivan, Speaker for Changing the Game, gave us this monster list a few years ago, and I'm making my way through it. One of the speakers I talked to, he was talking about David Epstein, who wrote a book on genetics, and he's got a great TED talk. And he goes, yeah, my favorite TED talk is that guy that talks about, and I'm like, we're both sitting there going, yeah, and tip of tongue could remember, but it's on the list. I don't know when I'll get to it because I'm trying to bang off a book a week. But it gets to be challenging when you're running summits and everything else. November is a tough month for me. But
yeah
I'm hearing that's a great one to read.
Yeah, yeah. There was also a book that hugely influenced me as a professional. And it was, I think it was entitled Feel the Fear and Do It Anyways. And because fear is a huge part of the reason why we don't move forward with the next step. We don't ask somebody on a date, or we don't speak up in a classroom. And I decided, you know, I think it was in my early 20s that I needed to be big and be bright and be loud and laugh and don't hide who you are and don't back down from challenges. Cause if you do, you will limit your growth. And it's nice to have the people that I have in my inner circle are all people that have said, here, let me help you up. Like I'm going to support you. And in return, I do the same for my friends. So surround yourself with people that elevate you and, you know, definitely don't let fear ever stop you.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest challenges that kids face today. Like I ask coaches in every clinic, why are you coaching? And I had a guy and share with me on the weekend, and it was kind of a tearjerker moment. He got up and he said, the reason I got into coaching is because my daughter played hockey. She quit hockey. And when I asked her, why are you quitting? He goes, because I'm scared of making mistakes. I'm scared. And I was like, that's just wrong. Like, and girls particularly, because we're really trying to get more female participation, coaches, everything right across the board. And he said, I just want to make it a fun and enjoyable for all the girls. And he kind of nailed it. Like we were like, and he started crying. And I was like, you know, a tearjerker moment. But that said, where else can kids learn to be safe to fail other than playing video games? Because if they fail, they just press the reset button. there's no other real environment in schools. You know, if you fail a test, you fail a test, but like you should be safe to fail in, yeah, in sports and activities. And that's where the free play element, like you think about it, when Bobby Orr's book, you know, whenever it was goal scored, all they did was grab the puck out of the net and kept going. Like there was none of this recent, you know, set up at middle ice, whatever the case would be. So I agree. We need to kind of get that out and bring the confidence and the safe to fail environment back. So what about for parents? Any books or resources you would recommend for parents?
I don't have one for parents. I've picked up a couple of books, but to be honest, they haven't captivated my attention, mostly because I feel like it's such common sense, to be honest.
Well, it is, but about 5 to 10% of parents, common sense, not so much there. They're taking a little over the top, but you know, they're probably not going to read those resources.
Yeah.
As long as we can tap into the silent majority and kind of steer them in the right direction, that's kind of the goal, right?
Yeah. We have a saying in my household, you can't argue with crazy. So we pick and choose our battles. I have to admit, it's, you know, definitely hand the mic over to the people that you need to speak up.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have a favorite TED Talk?
You know what? I was just listening to the one last night about the growth mindset, the not yet. So rather than saying you've failed, it's you say you haven't figured this out yet. And the power of that phrase encourages continued investment and continued trial. And I really like that shift.
That's great.
I love TED Talks. It's like every 20 minutes. Give me 20 minutes.
Yeah, you know, the snippets that they're sharing, and some of them are 8 to 12 minutes. Like the 40s sometimes are the great ones. Like Reed Maltby, my buddy, did a great one in 8 minutes. I'm just like, you know, power coaches words. And but TED, I think, has kind of lost a little bit of momentum because it's been around for so long. But that said, there's still some great snippets. My favorite is, and probably always will be, John Wooden's. He's the only person ever in the history of TED that got to sit in the chair for, it was almost 20 minutes, and he just started telling his story. And one of our speakers for this event is Dr. Gordon Bloom from McGill. And I had Jean Côté and Wade Gilbert in our summer summit. And Wade and Gordon actually had an opportunity to be in a car with a coach in LA, going back and forth for like about 40 minutes each way. So it was just like there, and all the nuggets that he shared. And I think at the time he was 80, like 90 years old, and they were just blown away at how all the great stuff that he shared, and was all about not him, but all the people that he interacted with, and truly a caring person. And just that talk, to me, has been my favorite, and continue to look for others that are like it, but there will never be another John Wood.
That's awesome.
So last question, rapid fire. What's the number one tip that you would share for youth sports coaches to help them shave 5 years off their learning curve?
I'm speaking to other coaches.
Yeah. So you're going to give a tip. You've been you're coaching right now. How long have you coached? Cause you're coaching Ben.
I've coached for about five years now.
Okay. So you're 5 years in. Look back 5 years ago.
Yeah.
and you're kind of like just being thrown to the wall. You put your hand up as a parent, because that's usually the case.
Yeah.
You're going to make some mistakes.
Yeah.
We all do. And there are mistakes I made. Everybody's made them. I've been in it for 20 plus years. But the reality is, what tip would you give to those guys that are just starting based on your 5 years to help them shave 5 years of mistakes?
Find a mentor. Yeah, there's been two people that have been instrumental in developing my my knowledge base and my research, and they really have shifted the way I analyze my drills, my practice plans, and without them, I would be lost in the internet probably. I don't think the internet replaces a good mentor.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. Probably the greatest mentor I ever had was my daughter's softball coach, which I ended up co-coaching with for years. Many times when the girls were warming up, throwing the ball, whatever, we'd be sitting in a dugout, And the nuggets he would share with me were like, blew my mind. And because he was a hockey and a softball guy, I asked him for tips. Hey, you know, how do I do this? How do I do that? He probably forgot more about both sports than I will ever know. And I've been at it for 20 years. Like, he knew that much. But the mentorship that I got was amazing. And that's what I tell every coach. Don't be scared. Go reach out to somebody. Get their insight, because there's lots of great, great people out there that will gladly help the new coaches, because that's the wave, right? And if
we do it professionally, right? You don't enter into a trade or a profession and do so alone as an island. You have supervision and you get guidance, and yet somehow as a coach, it's you seem flawed if you have questions and if you're not certain, and you have to be willing to say you need help for sure.
Absolutely, because the mistakes you make potentially could push those kids out of the game that they once loved, and that's the last thing that anyone wants to do. So,
a personal note, Glenn, I wanted to let you know too that I've been practicing physio for 22, 23 years now, and my hands are getting sore, and I own my company, so I can take a step back. And this winter, I'm taking a look at offering multi-sport camps. I'm wanting to construct something for the 9 to 12-year-olds and make it playful as an alternative, particularly in the early part of July. Like, August seems to be about hockey, so
yeah,
kids are
painfully so.
So, you know, those first 2 weeks, how can we get, we've got, it was a thing with my brother. I wanted to do hike up with Hartnell Down because we have lots of mountains. I'm like, let's hike up. And it's amazing how many kids have not hiked the mountain that is in their own backyard. You know, we live on an ocean and half these kids haven't done stand up paddleboarding. So, you know, you can't put the onus on the children. I get it. There needs to be downtime. I'm hopeful that we can create something. I've got tons of good teacher friends and tons of good coaches in my network, and I'm hoping that we can pull something together that's pretty special. So I'll let you know how that goes.
On a closing note, you know, I think that this was amazing. Like, I just loved our chat, and I want to thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it. It was great.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook, For Love of the Game, Twitter, TLOTG Conference, and forlovethegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.